It was the question Howard Baker will always be remembered for.
What did the president know, and when did he know it?
The startling announcement from Jim Jeffords.
I will leave the Republican Party and become an independent.
The sad outburst from Marion Barry.
It set me up like this.
All made a major impact in the world of politics, and all left us this year. From WAMU 88.5 in Washington, I'm Ken Rudin, and this is the 2014 Remembrances Special for the Political Junkie. ...2014 ended just as it began, with both parties sniping at each other. It's the kind of partisanship that's been part of our politics for a long time. But it was also a year in which we lost some giants in the political world. Presidential candidates, senators, governors, mayors, public servants, journalists. For better or worse, these people helped make our lives more interesting and tried in their own way to make the world a better place. We're going to spend the next hour remembering them. We'll hear their life's highlights and lowlights in their own voices. We'll hear from those who knew them. And we'll talk about them here in the studio with Janet Hook, a political correspondent with the Wall Street Journal, and Alan Ehrenhault, a senior editor of Governing Magazine and the author of four books, including The United States of Ambition. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Hi, Ken.
I know a lot of us check out the obituary page every day, or at least I do, probably to make sure that we're not... our names are not on it, but I always get a twinge of sadness or pain when I read about the death of someone who spent much of his or her life giving of themselves in public service. Are you addicted? Do you read the political obituaries? Are you drawn to them?
Actually, as a political journalist, I kind of enjoy writing them because it's a way of taking the measure of a politician and the impact they have that, you know, when you're just covering them on a day-to-day basis, you just don't have that opportunity. And so you can kind of see the whole beginning, middle, and end of somebody's life and what impact they've made.
The good and the bad.
The good and the bad.
Alan, yeah?
I'm not an obituary reader. I tend to avoid them.
You're not an habitual obituary reader?
No. I prefer to think everybody's still alive.
So I want to start off with Howard Baker. I mean, is there anyone in politics these days as well-liked as Howard Baker?
Howard Baker really was a well-liked senator when he was... He was the senator from Tennessee for a long time, and by the end of his career, he was the leader of his party. And it might be said that he was so well-liked, he was almost too nice to be a presidential candidate. He tried and considered running for president a couple of times. And part of, I think, his problem was, as I said, it wasn't just that he was nice. It was that he was a very accommodating legislator who wanted to get things done in the Senate. And as a result, he was probably not pure enough for his party to nominate him for president.
Well, Alan, part of the problem Howard Baker had when he ran for president in 1980 was his support of the Panama Canal Treaty.
Well, that had a lot to do with it. But what Howard Baker did in the early 80s, in the beginning years of the Reagan administration, was keep a pretty fractious Republican Party in the Senate together. Republicans had the majority for 6 years in the 1980s, and he was the majority leader. And really did a pretty good job at keeping things moving.
We started this show off by that famous quote of Howard Baker, what did the president know, when did he know it? He was one of the members of the Senate Watergate Committee in 1973 who basically began his rise in national politics.
That certainly did put him in the public spotlight in a way that he certainly hadn't been before. And he was kind of the perfect choice for that role. He had this kind of lawyerly kind of moderate approach to questioning people. And because he was questioning the president of his own party, you know, he gave that question some real oomph and credibility.
I remember reading somewhere that, you know, he had originally run against Hugh Scott.
I was going to mention
the Republican,
that.
And so Hugh Scott put him on the Senate Watergate Committee as like punishment.
Yeah, I mean, people think of Baker as somebody who was not a man of overweening ambition. But after 2 years in the Senate, he ran for Republican leader, in part because Everett Dirksen, who had just died, was his father-in-law. And he tried to claim some sort of inheritance of the mantle, and he nearly won.
Yeah, and it was also after he realized he could not be president and left the Senate, he came back to public service as Ronald Reagan's chief of staff.
Yes, that was a big big job to fill because he came into the Reagan White House when it was a very troubled time for him, oversaw the whole period of the fallout from the Iran-Contra affair. He was kind of considered the kind of adult supervision for a really troubled period of Reagan's presidency.
Well, earlier this year, we interviewed Tom Griscom. Tom Griscom was a longtime top aide to Senator Baker. Here's part of that interview.
You get this sense of people thinking that there were not tough debates, and tough debates not only between Republicans and Democrats, but within the Republican majority that he led in the United States Senate. And I've reminded people, you know, that these were really hard issues, and they went at it. But the difference is one thing, Ken, and that is when the session ended, they could all get together and they could come together as friends. They did not take it personally. I mean, I can recall times where Senator Helms from North Carolina was tying up Senator Baker in the Senate in knots, but he was waiting to get a one vote on an issue so he could put out a mail piece attacking Teddy Kennedy. Once he got it, it was fine. And those are the kind of things that get people to realize it wasn't like a day where there weren't disagreements. It's just a time where people realized that at the end of it, they could all walk away and look at each other and be friends. Senator Baker, Ken, used to say, you know, honest people can disagree, and that's okay. It doesn't mean we can't be friends.
Well, you know, of course, he led the Republican Party before there was a Tea Party, but you're right, there were ideological divisions, and there were liberals like Jacob Javits, and Baker somehow had to get Javits and Helms and people like that on the same page.
Well, you're right. I used to say Senator Baker had the patience of Job, because he'd be sitting there, and you're right, Ken, trying to figure out and find that way to connect a liberal Republican senator with a very conservative Republican senator. And he would do it. Maybe the best story that sort of illustrates it is after the 1980 election, when all these senators got swept in with President Reagan, and many of them had never served in political office, and much less in the role they're walking into. So we have a vote coming to extend the debt limit. And you've got all these conservative Republican freshman senators who said, we ran against that. And so Senator Baker had him walk out of the Senate chamber down to his office, which was about, you know, a couple hundred feet from the Senate floor. And he had Senator Thurmond with him. And they got around this table in Senator Baker's office, Ken, and Senator Baker turned to Senator Thurmond. And Senator Thurmond said, I have never voted for a debt limit extension in my career. He said, but I've never had Ronald Reagan as a president. They walked out of that room, went back to the floor of the Senate. They got the Republican votes they needed, and then Senator Byrd, the Democratic leader, provided the rest on his side of the aisle. That's what it took. That's the way to sit down and have people understand that sometimes the issues are bigger than the last thing you ran for or the last time that you stood up and made some statement. You have to realize that when you are in that position, you're one of 100 votes that can change the course of the country.
That was longtime Howard Baker aide Tom Griscom. Baker died in June this year at the age of 88.
And the high points of my career, at least, of the Congress, it was marked by the willingness, either publicly or privately, to recognize that we need to think about something else except those things that we are particularly interested in. That is the essence of politics.
Howard Baker made it to the White House, but never as president. Another presidential wannabe was Reuben Askew. He came out of nowhere to be elected governor of Florida in 1970. Less than 2 years later, he was offered the number two spot on the McGovern ticket, but didn't take it. And in 1984, he sought the Democratic presidential nomination, but went nowhere. But he is a giant. He's considered one of the greatest governors in the nation's history. Eugene Stearns is a Miami trial lawyer and a former top advisor to Askew. We spoke to him several months ago.
Perhaps my proudest moment of dealing with Governor Askew was when the Republicans in the legislature put on the ballot a proposal to a straw vote to ask Floridians, are you for or against forced busing? And we sat down with the governor and said, you know, listen, where are we on this? And the governor said, listen, I'm not crazy about the idea of busing children past their neighborhood schools, but let's face reality. We have a problem in Florida. It is not separate but equal. It is not equal. And we simply need to go through a process of paying the price of centuries of being wrong. And so, and frankly, I'm embarrassed that the state of which I'm governor is putting an issue like that on the ballot. And so a bunch of us got together and we said, okay, governor, we can raise money for you to go on television and oppose the referendum. And so there were some of his political advisors who said, you'll get killed, you'll lose popularity, you know, you want to run for reelection, you're never going to win. But there were a few of us on who worked with him closely who were able to convince him that, A, you need to do it, and B, if you do it, you're not going to win the argument in this state because the feelings were very high and opposition was so great. But I will guarantee you that at the end of the day, people will admire you and respect you for the strength of your feelings, the courage with which you've expressed them. And he did that, and the strangest thing happened. After he did it, after he lost that vote, which everybody knew he would, his popularity in Florida just soared through the ceiling. Because people who didn't agree with him on the issue came out and say, this is one tough guy. He's a strong guy, a man of principle, a man of courage. He's a deeply religious man. He cares about this. And so I really am proud to have a governor like this guy, governor of my state. So what he did in that campaign was eliminate Florida nationally as being a state that was identified like Alabama or Mississippi with a governor standing in the schoolhouse door. And I think people in Florida, even people that didn't agree with the position he was expressing, just felt so proud that we would have a governor with such courage and character. So that to me was probably one of the most shining moments in his career.
Well, that courage obviously translated nationwide. He was named the keynoter to the 1972 Democratic Convention, and George McGovern actually is reported to have offered him the vice presidential running mate.
Yes, he did, and I talked to him about that at the time, which was a great honor. But obviously, Governor Askew was basically a fairly conservative guy, and for example, when he made his brief foray into presidential politics, he expressed views on abortion that made him unacceptable to a Democratic Party national audience. That's really what ultimately killed his campaign early on, is that he just couldn't stand up and say something that he didn't believe in. So regardless of what the vote, those of us who liked him and supported him thought, he was just a guy that wasn't going to make it up to please people. And the truth is that you can't be involved in politics very long in a national stage without having to bend your principles. And that was not something he was ever going to do.
The Kennedy School at Harvard University rated him as one of the top 10 governors of the 20th century. That's pretty impressive. When you think of Reuben Askew and his years as governor and his years of serving Florida, what's his legacy?
His legacy is sadly being eroded, if you want to know the honest truth, because what he did is being undone. Tax fairness is being undone. The rules to protect the environment have been largely undone. Ethics rules have, constantly need to be improved, not watered down, and they've been constantly watered down. So you have a legacy of a guy who was quite unusual but quite singular in his approach to politics. Most people don't realize, in a practical sense, why Reuben Askew was able to be who he was and what he was, which is he ran a campaign for governor in 1970 with no money at all, no money. He had just pennies compared to the millions that were being spent by his opponents. And he won with no money. And so we can all talk about campaign finance reform and we need to provide money for this guy and that guy. Reuben Askew in a state in 1970 proved that you could win with ideas if you had other things going for you and the ability to explain them. What he did, the sad thing is that no one learned from it. So it didn't turn out to be a legacy because it was a fleeting example of how you can beat the system and elect somebody who isn't owned. Because let's face reality, when you run for office and you raise millions of dollars, the people who are giving to your campaign expect something for it. And he didn't have any of that. I mean, no, he could deal with every interest group in Florida. and deal with them decently and honestly and aggressively, and know that he wasn't beholden to any of them. And I dare say there hasn't been any politician in Florida since who could say that.
That was Eugene Stearns, a former top advisor to Florida Governor Reuben Askew. The governor died in March.
A famous theologian of the United States Senate once said, his name was Everett Hale. He was a descendant of the patriot, American patriot Nathan Hale. He said, I can't do everything, but I can do something. But because I can't do everything, I'll not refuse to do the something I can do.
Another presidential hopeful and political giant we lost this year was Phil Crane. His career started with a special election to the House of Representatives in 1969. Somebody by the name of Donald Rumsfeld resigned to join the Nixon administration. From the moment he was first elected to Congress in Illinois, Phil Crane became a national conservative leader. Alan Ehrenhold, you remember Phil Crane. In the political world, when Richard Nixon was just elected president, Phil Crane stood out.
That's true, but he never was much of a congressman, actually. In terms of being a legislator, he didn't show up a lot. I remember him walking into the Ways and Means Committee one day in the late 70s and getting sarcastic applause from his own side of the aisle.
Because he showed up.
Because he finally showed up. I think he felt a little bit above the legislative process, and it's fair to say he didn't accomplish much as a legislator. His great accomplishment was his campaign for president.
Janet, he ran for president in 1980, sought the Republican nomination. Initially, he ran for president thinking Ronald Reagan was not going to run, and he thought he would be the conservative choice for 1980. The campaign didn't get that far.
That's right, and it's not clear that it would have gotten that far even if Ronald Reagan hadn't run. It was a reminder that being a House member isn't a very good platform for running for president. It hasn't happened more than
James Garfield in 1880.
Right.
Yes,
right. Dick Gephardt tried.
Yeah,
yeah. No, actually, I mean, I think his bigger accomplishments were political accomplishment was kind of outside Congress and independent of running for president. I mean, forming the American Conservative Union. And when he was in Congress, he actually helped found the Republican Study Committee, which started out being this tiny little faction of conservative House members that now is it's kind of a must-belong organization in the House. Almost all of the members of the House Republican Conference belong to it.
Well, you mentioned the American Conservative Union. He was chairman of that. David Keene was also the longtime chairman of the American Conservative Union. He's now the opinion editor of the Washington Times. David Keene remembers Crane's election in 1969 as big news for conservatives.
Well, Richard Nixon, of course, had just become president, elected in November of 1968. And the congressman from that district in Illinois was a young Don Rumsfeld.
Whatever happened to him?
Well, that's right. Nixon picked Rumsfeld to run and reform the OEO, the Office of Economic Opportunity, which is about as remembered now as Phil Crane is, but was a big deal in 1969. Don gave up his seat, and everybody in the district jumped into the primary. Phil Crane was perhaps the most lightly regarded of the candidates initially because he was an intellectual and a professor and a writer.
And very conservative.
And very conservative. He had made his name really among conservatives. He was the issues research director in the Goldwater campaign. He was a professor at Bradley University at that time. But Phil was articulate, intellectual, attractive, and spent all of his time traveling from campus to campus at a time when the conservative movement, which was very young in the early 1960s, was just beginning to grow and to morph from an intellectual campus-based movement, as a lot of these movements begin, into a political organization. In fact, if you're talking about Phil Crane, not only was he a hero to young conservatives in the mid-60s, but a lot of the people who are today leading conservatives would never have gotten involved were it not for Phil Crane.
He was in Congress for less than 10 years when he decided one way to become even more of an influential figure in the Republican Party was to run for president. He announced it in 1978, 2 years before the election, and he was offering conservative principles. Let's listen.
The objective, of course, is to build back into the system the incentives for people to work, to be taxpayers instead of tax consumers, to guarantee them that if they practice the traditional virtues, they'll be rewarded.
And he could never be accused of being an environmentalist.
We should also be burning the coal resources, and I favor putting a moratorium on the environmental regulations while we burn coal. At the same time, we're producing gas and oil here at home to get out from under this dependence, because the alternatives the administration's been talking about is the possibility of a war. And when someone told me the other day, didn't I think I was risking losing the environmentalist vote, I said yes, until the first environmentalist son is killed in the Middle East trying to keep the oil supplies going.
But he was more of an economic conservative than a social conservative. Like, he never talked about issues like abortion or gun control.
No,
like
he was a small government, limited federal power, economic conservative, much in the mold of Barry Goldwater and Ronald Reagan at that time. You know, and what happened in 1980 was Phil's fame actually was established by the Panama Canal fight. I mean, he, as chairman of the American Conservative Union, led that fight, and it was a big one. It influenced the makeup of Congress. It probably ended Howard Baker's chances of ever being a viable presidential candidate. And he came out of that in 1978 thinking, as a lot of conservatives did, and it's difficult for us today looking back to realize what the world was like at a different time. But in 1978, a lot of people did not think Ronald Reagan was really going to run for president in 1980. And a lot of other people, and I worked for Reagan in 1976, and a lot of other people thought that if he did, he wouldn't do that well because he was an older guy and he seemed rusty and slow. And in actuality, Ronald Reagan, as everybody learned later, was a guy whose mind went into neutral until it was challenged. And right. When it was challenged, you were in deep trouble.
I mean, Jimmy Carter, the word was Jimmy Carter wanted to run against Ronald Reagan because
he did the
easiest one to beat.
That's right. And so Phil, in 78, decided he was going to be, and not illogically, if Reagan were not on the scene, he was going to stand up and be there as sort of the backup. And he said initially that if Reagan were to get into it, he'd be happy to get out. But, of course, the problem with people that run for president is that once the bug bites them, they can't get out. So he didn't. And, of course, he was easily trounced and withdrew after the New Hampshire primary. But several things were happening then that's the reason a lot of people don't remember Phil today, and that is, one, he was pushed to the sidelines as the Reagan juggernaut went forward, and secondly, a whole new generation of conservatives were coming to the fore, and he was not part of that parade.
You know, I'm sitting here listening to the questions I'm asking you, and it sounds to me
so
that—
So am I.
Yeah, well, somebody should be listening.
That's right.
But it feels like I'm talking more about bad things or sad things about Phil Crane than the good things. But there was a time when he lit a fire under the conservative movement.
Oh, he was crucial. He cared about things. And if you were a young conservative, as I was, and he was one of my heroes back then, on a college campus, wherever it was in the United States, the odds are that either Young Americans for Freedom, which was an important political youth organization at the time, or ISI, the Intercollegiate Society of Individualists, now the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, was sponsoring something where you would meet and hear Phil Crane. He'd come to your campus. He went to hundreds of campuses. He was always available to talk, and he would hang out, and he would recruit you into the movement. So he was crucial to that period, because remember, this, again, is hard to remember looking back, particularly for young people. There wasn't much of a viable conservative movement in this country in the 1960s. And conservatives were derided by the media and by intellectuals as being non-intellectual, as not having many ideas. We had Bill Buckley, and that was about it. But on campuses, you had this guy who was articulate, who was friendly, who was smart, who was willing at any time of the day or night to discuss ideas, who was a history professor, who'd wrote a book called The Democrat's Dilemma about the Fabian socialism and its influence in this country. And he was somebody that you could say, oh yeah, what about Phil Crane?
That's former American Conservative Union Chairman David Keene remembering his colleague Phil Crane, who died this year on November 8th. He was 84 years old.
Through the classroom, education, and students bothering to dig a little deeper than the superficialities of headline writing and, their 30-minute bites on television, to arrive at an understanding of the facts, then to communicate that to friends, neighbors, and relatives, and then to get out to the polls and change the composition of the Congress and the course of our history.
When Phil Crane was defeated for re-election in 2004, he was the longest-serving Republican member of the House. Let's switch gears a little bit and go to Boston. The longest-serving mayor in Boston history was Tom Menino. He was the first Italian-American mayor in a city long known for its Irish politicians. At one point, his approval ratings were 82%. Andrew Ryan covered him as a reporter for the Boston Globe.
So Boston was a very different place in 1993. It was a time, and this was happening nationally, where people were leaving the city. You know, for several decades, people had been fleeing to the suburbs, and Boston was still getting over explosive race relations in the 70s that lasted into the 80s. So Boston was a very different place than it is today.
He was obviously very much underestimated. How come?
Well, he was not a telegenic politician. I mean, in his first campaign, he talked to, he always used the phrase that he was not a fancy talker. His nickname in office had become Mumbles. But he was a workhorse, and he was much more of a workhorse than a show horse. So what he did was he just showed up everywhere. He would show up to anything. He used to bring his own scissors to ribbon cuttings, and he would cut ribbons all over the city. He would, stop at several coffee houses on the way into City Hall. He would go to kids' birthday parties. He, spent basically two decades going to everything he could possibly go to. And that's how he built relationships with people kind of one at a time.
He had said that his biggest accomplishments were reducing crime, improving education, boosting employment, plus, in addition to that, making the city more inclusive. How did he actually stack up?
I mean, I guess probably to some degree time will tell. What we know now is, when he took office in 1993, it was news that he was Italian. That was diversity because he wasn't Irish, because we had had a long string of Irish mayors. One of the things that he did in his career was, he had tremendous support in communities of color. And we really saw that this week in the funeral services for him and he had tremendous support in the gay community. And that's partially because he was, light years ahead of his time in terms of gay rights. Back in the mid-90s, he was, boycotting the St. Patrick's Day parade because, they wouldn't let, openly gay marchers in. When the state's highest court in Massachusetts legalized gay marriage in 2004, when they were ahead of public opinion, it was not what we've seen, the shift that we've seen today. But, he actually, not only did he support it, but, he rolled out the red carpet. He was literally standing behind the first couple when they filled out their marriage applications, which was a pretty significant thing for, a devout Catholic who, not only went to Mass every Sunday, but, prayed all the time. He championed underdogs a lot. That helped kind of define his 20 years in office.
What would you say that some of the stuff that he did was bad, was not so good?
He certainly could hold grudges. I think that those have been well documented. Schools, like all cities, urban education has not been solved here in Boston. Certainly have been some strides that were made, but there's still a lot of work that needs to be done on schools. He was always criticized for not having a grand vision. And, he had this the quote which led our obituary of him was, that visionaries don't get things done. And I think that there is some truth in that, but I think there were certain times where he would propose things that where he was looking for some sizzle or a headline, and it, then kind of didn't work out. Like he'd proposed building a 1,000-foot tower, and he wanted to build something big on City Hall Plaza, and, hadn't really – so he made this big announcement, but really hadn't investigated well. And I think the FAA and was against it, and the federal government, because there was a federal building next door, was against it. So sometimes things would come out half-baked. If you look at a 20-year career, he probably had a pretty good batting average if you were going to weigh everything all together.
What will you remember most about him?
Probably one of his greatest skills was getting people to underestimate him. And, and part of that was from him because he wasn't all that articulate. And so I think people would, kind of write him off sometimes. Sometimes he would have these little tricks. Sometimes I think he would pretend he couldn't hear questions. and then would, you know, kind of say, you know, very sharp, like what would come out of his mouth to kind of catch you off guard. And a lot of times I think it was manufactured. He was a very, very sharp man who, you know, and I think that I'll miss. And, you know, in his sense of humor, he loved to gossip. He loved to find out what was happening in the city and, you know, what I had heard. He prided himself on, you know, being very much on the pulse of the city.
That's the Boston Globe's Andrew Ryan talking about his time covering Mayor Tom Menino. Menino died on October 30th, just after ending his unprecedented fifth term as mayor of Boston.
I used to stop at 3 coffee shops in the morning just to talk to people. I don't drink coffee.
Yeah, I was going
to
say, you don't drink coffee.
No, but yeah. I want to see what they were talking about. And that's where you get your feelings of what you should be doing as a mayor.
Alan Ehrenholt, you're at Governing Magazine. You would write about public officials who would do what Menino seemed to excel at, the ability to create jobs, improve infrastructure, education, reduce crime. That's the kind of record that gets a mayor reelected 5 times.
Well, it is. And in Menino's case, his secret was that he cared about small things. He would ride through the city in his car, and he would point out potholes, and he would point out businesses where the sign was off kilter, and nothing was too small for him. And it was the accretion of all of these small issues and problems that he took care of that gave him the political clout to do big things. And he really had a sense of how to be a mayor and what mayors need to do.
There are some mayors, you think of John Lindsay in New York and maybe Sam Yorty in Los Angeles, who looked at bigger pictures, maybe statewide office, maybe a presidential race. Tom Menino is very happy to be in Boston.
Tom Menino had a different philosophy than most mayors. Most mayors come into office and ask, what's the toughest problem I can work on? And Tom Menino said to himself, what's something small that I can do and get started? And that really served him well for 20 years.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Political Junkie 2014 Remembrances Special. We're remembering the political giants who passed away this year. My guests are the Wall Street Journal's Janet Hook and Alan Ehrenholt, senior editor of Governing Magazine. Welcome back to the Political Junkies 2014 Remembrances Special. I'm Ken Rudin in Washington. I'm here with Alan Ehrenholt, senior editor of Governing Magazine, and Janet Hook of the Wall Street Journal. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
So far, we've taken a look at some political giants who passed away this year. Senator Howard Baker, the conservative icon Phil Crane, Boston's mayor for life Tom Menino. They certainly made history and made a difference. But let's all talk about someone who made headlines. Certainly one of the rogues who will long be remembered is James Traficant, the outlandish Ohio congressman who went to prison for corruption. Thinking about him makes me sad, but it also makes me smile. Can we all agree that he was certainly outrageous, Janet?
Yes, he became famous for some of the speeches that he would give on the House floor, and his signature phrase was, beam me up, Scotty, at the end.
Well, let's hear one of those famous rants.
Think about it. After our taxpayers are hit with unnecessary tax bills heavy enough to cause a hernia for the Jolly Green Giant, they're told, if you don't like it, sue us. This isn't hearsay. This isn't rumor. This is an exact quote of an IRS agent who also said, beware, Congress, the IRS will tell you these are isolated incidents. That's not true. This is, in fact, standard policy. Beam me up. I say it's time for Congress to shove these illegal tactics right up the assets of the IRS.
Janet, I mean, I don't know where you go from there. There's very few like Jim Traficant.
Yeah, no, he really had a way with dramatic flourish on the House floor. And actually, he was one of the pioneers of the use of the one-minute speech. After they started televising the House's operations through C-SPAN in the late 1970s, some members of Congress figured out that that was a way of getting to a broader audience. The C-SPAN audience is kind of a niche audience, but he was one that really kind of grabbed onto the one-minute speech and figured out how to blast it out to the country.
Alan, is there a particular rant, Jim Traficant rant, that you remember?
I have a Jim Traficant rant that goes back, far before his congressional career. Not many people know he was the star quarterback for Pitt in the 1960s. Before one big game against University of Miami, he was talking to reporters and he said, "You boys are going to see a Heisman Trophy performance out there today." And sure enough, the Miami quarterback, whose name was George Myra, actually did win the Heisman Trophy that year, but it wasn't Trafficant.
But Trafficant did have some Heisman moments on the floor of the House.
Yeah, he
certainly
did.
He was certainly a character, but the truth is he was also corrupt. Paul Sarasik is a political science professor at Youngstown State University. He's an expert on all things Trafficant.
Well, you know, one of the most common ways Jim Trafficant was referred to around here was "Our Jimmy," and that kind of says a lot. I mean, he emerged from this community, and in many ways, I think a lot of people here thought he spoke for this community, and you know, for their sense of the world. I mean, to understand, you know, this area, you have to go back into the late 1970s when the steel mills closed here, and thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of people eventually lost their job. And their perspective was that kind of the outside world, which doesn't make any sense, did something tremendously unfair to them. And it starts this kind of us against the world mentality here. And Jim Trafficant was the perfect spokesman for that point of view.
Well, one of the things everybody knew about him, even in the years before he ran for Congress, I mean, he was always accused of being in cahoots with mobsters or up to some kind of nefarious scheme. In fact, he was indicted for taking bribes in 1982 before he ran for Congress, and yet he was acquitted. So he was some kind of a hero against the establishment.
Sure. I mean, and the acquittal is really kind of stunning because he'd actually signed a confession. And, you know, he represented himself before the federal government. I mean, everyone knows that the federal government wins most of the time in court, an incredible number of time. And to have someone who wasn't an attorney even, you know, representing himself and beating the big guys, I mean, it's really almost a David versus Goliath story that you know, he shouldn't have won that. And, it, you know, it really makes him, along with his actions, you know, as a sheriff not foreclosing, you know, a local hero. And, you know, the trials in 1983, in 1984, he turns around and runs and gets elected to Congress.
And the voters loved him, right?
Yes. You know, he barely had to campaign. I still remember his very small sort of green and white, you know, Trafficant for Congress signs that would appear every 2 years. The same signs, you just recycle them. He didn't really have to run. You know, he was so well known here and really loved. And it wasn't just, you know, the 1 minute speeches. It was also, you know, people felt here that he cared about them. You know, Trafficant was one of the first people to sort of rail against, you know, immigration and talk about securing our southern border. But, you know, I'll tell you, the first time I ever met Jim Trafficant, I was actually at a Chinese New Year celebration with a local Chinese American community who had embraced Trafficant because he had been so helpful to them in working out some immigration problems over the time. So there's all these contradictions. You know, he's this big, almost sort of dangerous guy. But at the same time, he clearly cared for his constituents and did his, you know, casework, as we say. He took care of the local people.
You mentioned those 1 minute speeches on the House floor. Okay, this is radio. Help explain what we saw when we turned on C-SPAN and saw a Trafficant on the House floor.
Right. Well, you know, first you have to realize he was huge. I mean, he was a big guy, a former high school football star who had been a star in college, University of Pittsburgh, had a tryout with the Pittsburgh Steelers. He was a big guy. He had, you know, it turned out it was a wig, but he had, you know, a big hair that he said, you know, he used to trim with a weed whacker, and that's what it looked like. Wore sort of outrageous suits or sweater vest or, you know, something. He was not a fashion plate, but just the opposite.
He wore bell bottoms or something like that?
Bell bottoms, denims, you know, you name it. It clearly, he was different. He stood out. Even if you had never heard of him before, if you saw that speech, you know, he's very animated, you know, waving his hands. You couldn't miss him. So it was a performance. I mean, he really was, you know, performing the role of the populist leader.
And this was a pretty much a Democratic district, but he was not your regular kind of Democrat. He was anti-abortion. And I remember once he voted for Dennis Hastert, a Republican, for Speaker against his own Democratic candidate for Speaker. So he was not always in lockstep with his party.
No. I mean, he didn't like, you know, Dick Gephardt. I mean, even after he gets convicted, he has not kind words for Representative Gephardt. But yeah, he votes for Denny Hastert. And, you know, the funny thing is, you know, I teach, you know, government classes here, and there's so many things you can illustrate with Jim Trafficant. I mean, you teach about the Speaker of the House and how he's elected by the whole House, and usually it's a party line vote, except when you have Jim Trafficant in there, who crosses party lines. And there's even a story here about that, because a few months after he did that. 20-some million dollars showed up in Youngstown to build a convocation center, a community center that no one had ever asked for. And it was in an emergency funding bill for Kosovo. So, you know, even with that, even though he got kicked off of committees after that, people kind of gave him credit for it, saying, I see, you know, he was smart. Look what we got in return. He knows how to work the system. So, you know, even that, he turned into a positive.
What ultimately ended his career? Talk a little bit about the indictment in 2001.
Right, he gets convicted on a 10-count federal indictment that there were a lot of different elements to it, including having, you know, the farm that he actually had the accident on. He would have he was convicted of having some of his, you know, congressional aides do work during work hours, you know, on that farm, of having local contractors do work essentially for free to build up the farm. He was convicted of taking about, I think, a $40,000 bribe from a local businessman here in turn for doing, you know, some favors. You know, but honestly, I showed up at that trial for a few days to watch what was going on. And, you know, he defended himself again, as he had done in 1983. And, you know, to most people that know anything about the law, it was kind of a huge mistake. Here he is, you know, a member of Congress, and this is kind of inside baseball, but there's something, you know, the speech and debate clause, which immunizes members of Congress oftentimes from being questioned about what they did on the floor of Congress, what they said. Had he had an attorney, I'm pretty sure that he would have made sure that Trafficking hadn't essentially waived that immunity. But he does by calling some testimony in sort of about that, so he doesn't have that kind of standard protection that a member of Congress would have. And it probably results, maybe he would not have been acquitted on all the charges, but, you know, as it's turned out, he was convicted on all the charges. Even after that, you know, he still, you know, runs to get elected, but once he goes to prison, he attempts to run from prison. I think the Congressional Research Service had to do a study to find out whether you could actually be elected from prison because of the requirement that you reside in the state.
Before you get to the part where he goes to prison, as you say, he famously defended himself on the House floor. Let's give it a listen.
Now, you go ahead and expel me, but you ran this place for 50 years, Democrats. And you made the IRS, the FBI, and Justice Department so strong, our people are afraid to death of them. I'm ready to go to jail. I'll go to jail before I admit to a crime I didn't commit. And there was never any intent to commit a crime. And when they start bringing letters that you send to cabinet members trying to help your people, folks, there was a dangerous precedent set in U.S. versus Trafficking.
So after he was convicted of the charges, the House voted 420-1 to expel him. He became only the second member of the House to be expelled since the Civil War. Paul, if there's such a thing as a Trafficking legacy, what would it be?
You know, I don't know. His very strong supporters will tell you that, you know, the law changing, the presumption of guilt when the IRS is involved, that was something that was sponsored by Trafficking and was passed. You know, his concern with border security was, you know, maybe ahead of its time. But I think the reality is, you know, a lot of those things might have happened, you know, without him or, you know, despite him, because he really wasn't that good when it came down to it as sort of working through the normal channels of Congress, you know, to make change. But, you know, certainly, you know, he's a personality. And, you know, his whole theme, beam me up at the end, I think is probably reflective of what a lot of people think about Washington, D.C., that it's sort of a foreign planet that isn't like the rest of the country. And when you hear the things that are said down there and argued about down there, that maybe a lot of Americans say, maybe, you know, beam me up, take me back to reality. That was, you know, Trafficking's message. And I think that still resonates, and he'll be long be remembered for that.
That's Youngstown State University Professor Paul Sarasik remembering Congressman Jim Trafficant. Trafficant died on September 27th. Corruption is one of those words that will always be associated with the four-term mayor of Washington, D.C., Marion Barry. There was that famous tape of him being busted by the FBI in a D.C. hotel room for doing crack. But there was also a lot more to Marion Barry than his arrest. He was a remarkable figure who played a big role in the history of the nation's capital. Here with more about Barry's legacy is Mike DeBonis of The Washington Post.
You know, if you asked him, if you were sitting here with us now, he would talk about all the downtown development. He would talk about, you know, some of the major projects that he got moved forward, the first convention center in the city. But when people are talking, you're hearing people talk about him these last couple weeks. They talk about him opening the doors of what had been essentially a lily white establishment in this city, both a business and political establishment, and opening it to not African Americans, yes, but also women, Latinos, gays and lesbians. Even in the 1980s, when gay rights was hardly a mainstream thing, you know, Marion Barry was known as a champion. But certainly foremost among them, the African American community in this city was guaranteed and given a place at the table in terms of city contracts, in terms of hiring in the city, and in terms of there just being a new expectation that if you were going to do business in this town, that you were going to have black executives in high positions and helping them to run your businesses and run your agencies and otherwise, you know, run this city. I was just at the Wilson Building, you know, with DC City Hall, just yesterday after Barry had passed, and I ran into a woman there who had come down to lobby her lawmakers on there's a trash dump next door to her house, and I was talking to her, and she said, "Marion Barry's gone. There's no one here left to fight for us," and there's still 12 members of that city council. And she did not believe that any one of them had her best interests at heart. And she started sobbing in the hallways of City Hall, remembering the fact that Marion Barry wasn't here anymore. And there are certainly differing schools of opinion on how much he did to help the lot of the poorest in the city. Under his watch as mayor, city agencies failed. Especially the human service agencies that were charged with the welfare of the least in the city. Many of them ended up in under court receivership. There was reckless spending, a series of scandals, famous series in the Washington Post about how the city treated developmentally disabled residents who had gone into these group homes that were under city control, that were being funded by the city under city oversight, and just were treated horribly. But on the other hand, it's very hard to walk down the street and talk to anybody who grew up in the city who does not remember participating in Mayor Marion Barry's summer youth employment program. Thousands and thousands of summer jobs went to kids in the city, not only gave them a check, probably their first honest paycheck, but known for giving them something to do while school was out during the summer. And it also just left a deeply favorable impression in many people's minds of what he did for the city.
And then comes the 1990 scandal, the FBI bust in the hotel room. When we looked at Marion Barry's career and talked about his death,
right?
The famous quote, you know, "the bitch set me up" and the cocaine and all that stuff, that was the lead, probably the lead of the obituaries. Is that an unfair description of Marion Barry, or is it is he a complicated man?
He's without a doubt a complicated man. In fact, if there's one word that has appeared in virtually everything written about him since his death, it's complicated. But I don't think it's unfair to put that toward the top of his obituary, of any remembrance of him, because it was tremendous. It was a tremendous setback for the city. It was tremendously embarrassing, and it was emblematic of not only that incident, but years and years of personal weakness that had preceded that. And afterwards, you know, not only when he was mayor, but when he, in his sort of twilight years on the city council, he always found a way to find trouble, whether it was, you know, not paying his taxes or getting a contract for his girlfriend or no matter what it was. But he always had a way of sort of bouncing back from whatever misstep he had made. And I think that's just – I think what people found most remarkable about him, and what led people really to see him as a champion and as a idol even was the fact that he never let any of this stop him. He always picked himself up and he moved on. To think that, you know, he would, you know, after having FBI agents bust into this hotel room and throw him against the wall, put him in handcuffs, that, you know, 4 years later, he's going to be running, not only running again, but leading and eventually win and return to the mayor's office is absolutely remarkable. And, you know, Marion Barry, for all of his faults, was always seen as a champion of the residents of the city against those congressional overlords. And that's part of the reason why he's remembered so fondly today.
That was the Washington Post Mike DeBonis talking about Marion Barry. Barry died November 23rd of this year.
God has blessed me to live this long, to serve this 40 years. And we all have a mission in life. And I'm convinced that my mission is public service.
If Marion Barry was flashy and often out of control, the same was never said about Jim Jeffords. He was the prototype of a Vermont Republican, solid but a bit dull. Do a Nexus search of flashy and Jeffords, and you probably won't find much. But he also made national headlines the day he left the GOP in 2001 and temporarily cost the Republican Party control of the Senate. Janet, do you remember that day?
I do remember that day. Jim Jeffords was one of a kind, and actually what he was one of a dying breed of Republican. He was a very, very liberal Republican, and he'd been voting out of step with his party for a long time. And then that he got to the point where he just decided he didn't want to be part of the party anymore, and it was at a time when the Senate was split 50-50. The Republicans controlled it by dint of having the vice president,
Dick Cheney.
And so when Jeffords decided to become an independent and caucus with the Democrats, that cost them the majority. And it just turned everything upside down in the Senate. And it was, and then the Democrats paid him back by letting him be chairman of the Environment Committee. But he really was kind of one of the last of the really liberal Republicans. There aren't many of them left these days.
Alan, are there any left in the Senate? I mean, Jim Jeffords basically... What Vermont used to produce were the kind of Republicans that Jim Jeffords was.
Right. And the fact that those kinds of people don't get elected anymore is one reason Vermont is a Democratic state now. Liberal Republicans really are a dying breed, not only in Vermont and New England, but everywhere in the country.
Now, I would like to say one thing about Jim Jeffords. He may not be flashy, but he was one quarter of the singing senators. Do you remember the four senator quartet? Trent Lott, Larry Craig, and John Ashcroft.
Well, Jim Jeffords had a voice certainly that day in 2001, and Bob Kinzel of Vermont Public Radio had covered Jeffords for years. He remembers that day.
I was there, and it was total bedlam there. You know, there were dozens of TV news crews there. Everybody knew what was going to happen at that point, but maybe the 48 hours leading up to that event also was really a crazy time here because people thought Jeffords was going to leave the Republican Party, but nobody could confirm it. And then that morning, all hell broke loose.
So what were his reasons for leaving the party?
Well, you know, I think, you know, let's look at his priorities in the Senate. He was someone who really cared about education programs in general. He also cared about special education and was very upset that the federal government was reducing its commitment to states in terms of special education. He cared about the environment. He was a big supporter of the Clean Air Act. He also supported agriculture programs. And I think what happened is the first 4 or 5 months of the Bush presidency showed Jeffords that Bush and the Republicans in the Senate and in the House had a very different agenda than Jeffords did. And it came down in May where there was a budget-cutting bill going through Congress. And Jeffords was assured by the White House that the education programs that he cared about would not be cut in the final version of the bill. But in fact, they were. And Jeffords was livid. And at that moment, he said, you know, I've been thinking about leaving the Republican Party. He had talked to a group of moderates about leaving the Republican Party. Every Wednesday, he had a lunch with Republican moderates in the U.S. Senate. And he had been hinting to them in April, I'm not so sure I'm so happy about what's going on here. And then when the education money was cut, Jeffords went to them and said, I'm out of here. I got bad news. I'm leaving the Republican Party. And I think the education cuts just symbolized for him everything that was wrong with the Republican agenda in Congress.
And what was so monumental about that decision was at the time, it was a 50-50 Senate with Vice President Dick Cheney casting the tie-breaking vote. But by him leaving the Republican Party, it suddenly became 50 Democrats, 49 Republicans, and one independent. And that made Tom Daschle the majority leader.
That's right. And there was a famous meeting between Daschle and Senator Jeffords. And I heard former Senator Daschle talking about it just a couple of days ago, in which Jeffords goes to Daschle and says, okay, I'm going to leave the Republican Party. I'm going to become an independent. I'm going to caucus with you. Here's what I want. Number one, I want to make sure that my staff is well taken care of. That's the most important thing. Two, I want your support for an agriculture program that will help dairy farmers. That's it. That's all I want. And Daschle says, okay, we'll do it. And a couple months later, there's a big fight over dairy programs. And Jeffords was a very strong supporter of setting a floor price for milk that if federal prices went below that, that farmers would be protected. And Daschle kept his word and helped Jeffords pass the dairy package.
Just 6 months before he switched parties or before he left the Republican Party, he was elected to his third Senate term as a Republican. It obviously left his friends in the GOP quite bitter.
They were more than bitter. They said they were betrayed. And at that event that you talked about where he announced that he was leaving the party, there was someone outside the hotel dressed up as Benedict Arnold. And that really symbolized how a lot of Vermont Republicans felt. They said, wait a minute, you got elected 6 months ago as a Republican, and now you're telling us that you have a problem with the party? They were outraged. And they said, here's what you should do. You should resign your Senate seat. We should call a special election. Go ahead, run as an independent. We'll have a Republican candidate. There'll be a Democratic candidate. If you think you can win as an independent, you go right ahead and do it. And Jeffords said, I'm not going to do that. I won with 65% of the vote in November. Vermonters support me. I'm staying. I'm going to serve out this full term. But the Republicans were really angry at him.
He was, I mean, this is perhaps what the Vermont Republican Party was at the time, but he was pro-choice, he was pro-gay rights, he was pro-education funding. These are not positions that are widely shared in the Republican Party today, certainly not among its senators.
That's exactly correct. And Jeffords always said at that time that he didn't leave the party left him. And I think that's what he started to see in Washington with the Republican agenda in 2001, that the party was headed way to the right, and he didn't want to go there.
What's your lasting memory of Jim Jeffords?
You know, my memory of him is he always said what he thought, and he was not the most articulate person in the world, but he always spoke with a lot of passion, and, you know, what you see is what you got. And he really believed in education. A lot of people do lip service on education and on dairy farmers, on agricultural policies. But he really had a passion for those things. And the other passion he had was sticking up for the little guy. And he felt that government had a responsibility, a duty to help people in need. And he was a very humble man. You know, after all the attention that he got when he left the Republican Party, you know, you'd think that would swell the heads of a number of other politicians. But it never affected Jeffords. He was the same person afterwards that he was before.
That's Bob Kinzel of Vermont Public Radio talking about Vermont Senator Jim Jeffords, who passed away in August of this year.
I am an optimist and have been every day of my life. With Lincoln, I hope that the mystic chords of memory will stretch from every battlefield and patriot grave to the hearts of the living, and that we will soon again be touched by the better angels of our nature.
Speaking of making history, Jane Byrne was the first and actually only woman ever elected mayor of Chicago. We had Marge Halperin, a former City Hall radio reporter, who covered Byrne on the show in November.
It was remarkable, and I think you would say, as you do with a lot of races like this, it may not be so much that she won, but that the machine lost. That is, it was their race to lose. And the mayor who had succeeded Richard J. Daley, Michael Bolandic, was not a strong personality. He was not particularly well-loved. The folklore is that he lost because of the blizzard of 79. But the way that happened was about bad management. He had, in order to clear the streets for the plows, he set up a school and park parking lots and said, get your car off the street by this date or it will be ticketed and towed, and park them here on these lots. Well, the city machine, the city that works, didn't work very well, and those lots weren't actually cleared. So people who could get their cars out under this blizzard drove up to these lots, and they were covered with snow. And the headline in the Tribune one morning is, Mayor Bolandic says, park here, with a big arrow pointing at a mountain of snow. And that was the beginning of the end for him. He didn't do his job.
Well, Jane Byrne, I think she called him the abominable snowman, right?
Right. And it stuck.
Of course, when Richard J. Daley was alive, I mean, he was just untouchable, at least as far as opponents in the primaries. But with him gone, obviously, the Daley machine had to fend against challenges that they were not used to fending, and let alone it was from a woman. Did gender play a role in that 1979 campaign at all?
I think it played a role in the establishment, whether it was a media establishment or the political establishment, not paying enough attention to her and not taking her seriously. But in the campaign itself, there was, I think, the kind of sexism that you would expect in the 70s, you know, mockery of how she looked. She wore a wig through the campaign for some reason I never understood and took it off when she was elected and didn't have to wear it anymore. But
what kind of a mayor was she? Or to paraphrase Ed Koch, how'd she do?
How'd she do? Well, she was in a lot of ways a study in contrast. That might be a kind way of saying she was rather erratic as a leader. Other words in the coverage this week were vindictive and mercurial. She was a tough lady, as you would have to be in that environment. But maybe she was tough in ways she didn't have to be. So just like Mayor Bolandic, who she succeeded, I think she created a lot of her own problems. But again, she was in an environment where sexism was not uncommon. And I want to say the press room at that time was viciously sexist. And so there were a lot of comments behind her back, and some of them not behind her back, I think. Mike Royko called her Ms. Bossy as sort of a play on, you know, Daley being the boss. And that kind of thing was easy to do. Her own husband, as I said, a former reporter in the City Hall press room himself, while he was dating her, made a lot of derogatory remarks and encouraged sort of the male cronyism about her and who he was dating and what she was like in a pretty crude way. And I think that carried over to a lack of respect when she became mayor, which was inappropriate. But she built on that with her own kind of erratic behavior.
When she ran for re-election, I mean, she basically talked about her 4 years in office helping businesses, encouraging the arts. And in the words of one of her campaign commercials, she said she turned the city around. Here's one of her ads.
New York City, $1 billion in debt.
Washington, D.C., a $15 to $20 million shortfall. Cities throughout the country in deep trouble. But in Chicago, Jane Byrne has put together a balanced budget. $428 million in construction and street repair. Added police and fire protection. And a property tax cut of $22 million and a head tax cut of 33%. Remember when they called this the city that works? Well, this city is back. Thanks to a lot of hardworking people and a mayor who could put it all together.
Of course, that was Jane Byrne's interpretation of it, but there was also dissatisfaction from African Americans. Black said she focused too much on downtown Chicago, not enough on poor neighborhoods. And that's what Harold Washington was running on.
Right. And she did cater to the white vote in the southwest and northwest quadrants of the city, have the sort of, we call them the bungalow belt kind of neighborhood. And she needed those votes, and she catered to them in terms of appointments that she made to the school board and others, and there was a lot of backlash regarding the appointments that she made. And she also courted union strife. She had strikes, bitter strikes, transit workers, firefighters, and the teachers. Three bad strikes. We spent a lot of time covering her by sitting on the floor outside of closed-door union negotiations during much of her tenure. And whether or not those agreements ultimately were good or bad, they created what I think is an unfortunate legacy. When Richard M. Daley followed her into office two terms later after Washington, he was always very much afraid of labor strife, and I think in part because he saw what Byrne went through and that how difficult it was for her and how it hurt her reelection chances. So he bought labor peace at any price. And today's mayor, Rahm Emanuel, has huge pension debt because of those sweetheart deals. I wouldn't directly say those are Byrne's fault, but they came and stemmed from her legacy in a way.
When you go back to that 1983 campaign, would she have won had Daley not split the white vote with her?
Her chances were much better, and she always thought that he took it from her. But ultimately, I'd have to go back and look at the numbers. I don't think it's a given. I think that there was just this movement fueled around Harold Washington. In some ways, you know, Byrne had run as a reformer and turned out not to be one. She denounced the city hall, the city council machine aldermen, the machine leaders. She denounced them as the evil cabal, but it didn't take long for her to cut a deal with them and put them into power. And those who supported her because they thought she was a reformer were severely disillusioned over and over again.
She served only one term. How will history rate her? How does Chicago remember her now?
Well, for the full length of the Richard M. Daley administration, which is more than 20 years, Chicago didn't think about her very much at all. He pretty much obliterated her. There were various things she put in place. There was a fountain that was a tribute to children and a veterans memorial kind of thing, and he took them down and moved them and put them away in storage and that kind of thing. He took away a lot of traces of her administration. There was a lot of bitterness between them. But in recent months, when she was ill, and I think family and friends understood that it was going to be serious illness in the final stages of her life, there was a movement to support her and to remember her and honor her. So I think that at this point, people understand she had a very difficult job. She might have made it harder than it needed to be, but nonetheless, the environment she was in was very difficult. Her daughter says she loved the city like no other and knew the city like no other, and that's probably true. I would say one of a kind was the headline in the Sun-Times the other day, and no one's going to argue with that.
That's former Chicago reporter Marge Halperin on what it was like to cover Jane Byrne. Jane Byrne died November 14th, 2014.
I truly believed, in fact, I used to put it on a lot of my things as a commissioner, that if one person, the quote was along these lines, if one person stands up for a principle or an ideal, they will be joined by forces and individuals with other ideals and other principles from across the globe. And together they will join together and make something. And I believed it. I still do.
Taking an hour to remember the great political figures who passed this year, and when we say great, we don't necessarily mean giants or headline makers. or even people who served in public office. Some never even ran. Their impact on the political world deserves some recognition, too. You might not be familiar with the name of Joan Adams. You probably knew her better as Joan Mondale, the wife of former vice president and 1984 presidential candidate Walter Mondale. Joan Mondale was a tireless promoter of the arts, widely known as Joan of Art. Here's her niece, Lucy Mondale, with some memories.
Joan really felt, and I thought this was best summarized, when she was quoted for an article in Japan. She had helped negotiate a deal where she got McDonald's to pay to hang art in a subway station in Tokyo. There was a quote from her in which she said something about, by putting art in a something as common as a subway station, you're saying that the people who walk through it are valuable. And I think that really embodied her appreciation. She brought art into everything she did early on in Fritz's political career. She wrote a book for children called Politics in Art. So she, having been thrust into politics, found a way to link art with politics. And she went on, she had a slideshow that she delivered for years and a presentation on politics in art. She could give it with her eyes closed. She did it so many times.
She loved the arts. She also loved Fritz Mondale. She often said that when she met him, it was love at first sight.
It was a very loving and very strong marriage. They married very shortly after they met, some 59 years ago, I believe. The love endured through many, many years of politics, attorney general of Minnesota, Senate, the vice presidency, a presidential run. All of those are not easy on a relationship or a family. But as Fritz told me actually recently, he said she never complained, and she didn't. She really brought her grace and her class to every aspect of her life.
You know, I'm just going to say that. I was listening to as you were saying it. You think Fritz Mondale losing 49 states to Ronald Reagan in 1984, obviously that couldn't have been a happy time for the Mondales, but I've never, ever seen a photograph of her without her trademark smile.
That's right. She just didn't complain, and she was a minister's daughter. I think that kind of shaped her outlook on life, which was, you know, when something happens, you try and make meaning of it and try and help other people through as well. And that's certainly what she did until her last day on earth. She was just a very loving and kind person. And, you know, toward the end of her life, Fritz just amazed me with his dedication to her.
Did she ever share any campaign stories? Anything that you remember? Do you have a favorite? Did she have a favorite?
One of the interesting stories that, you know, I would think about that really was just the most poignant was when Paul Wellstone, for whom I used to work, was killed in a plane crash the week before the election in 2002. He was in a tight race. The Minnesota Democratic Party, the DFL party, asked Fritz if he would step in, come out of retirement and step in and take Wellstone's spot on the ballot. And he and Joan both, you know, they were retired. They were enjoying living their life. And Aunt Joan was a very avid potter, and she enjoyed making pottery. They just had a really nice life, very involved in the arts in Minnesota. But without even hesitation, the two of them together, I mean, it's not the kind of decision he would have made without her, but the two of them stepped in and, you know, basically started from scratch with 5 days left to go. And, you know, he didn't win, but, he fought the good fight. And that was very typical of both of them.
That's Lucy Mondale remembering her aunt, Joan Mondale, the wife of the former vice president and advocate of the arts, died in February of this year. She was 83. If you're just joining us, I'm Ken Rudin, and this is the 2014 Political Junkie Remembrances Special. We're taking an hour to remember the political giants and headline makers we lost this year. I'm joined by The Wall Street Journal's Janet Hook and Governing Magazine's Alan Ehrenhalt. Thank you both for joining me. And when I think of Jeremiah Denton, the Alabama Republican, I remember less about his one term in the Senate and more about the time after he was shot down over North Vietnam. Back in 1966, he was on TV being interrogated by a North Vietnamese officer in a news conference for propaganda purposes. The sound quality isn't great, but let's listen.
I get adequate food and adequate clothing. and medical care when I require it.
The sound quality of the video is not the point. During the interview, as Denton was calmly answering his interrogator's questions, he was blinking his eyes in Morse code to reveal the word torture. It was the first time the rest of the world learned that American prisoners of war were being tortured. Pretty remarkable. Janet?
It was. Really a great cause for celebrity for him when he did choose to run for office. Now, actually, I do remember his 6 years in the Senate. It was actually right after I got to Washington, the 1980 election came, and he was part of this big class of Republicans elected with Reagan, the Reagan landslide of 1980.
And they took control of the Senate that year.
They took control of the Senate that year. But he was also one of the casualties of when you come into office on a landslide, sometimes when you stand for re-election, you're not standing on very strong footing.
As always, we remember people from the world of politics, but we also remember the people who cover them. One of the most heralded journalists of our time was Ben Bradlee, the legendary Washington Post editor who stuck by his reporters during his newspaper's investigation of a famous, or should I say a third-rate break-in, at the Watergate office building. Janet, there was very few like Ben Bradlee.
Yeah, I never met the man, so I only know him by reputation, and all the journalists who've worked for him said that he was a really inspirational editor. He did have the impact of kind of glamorizing the profession that I then came to enter. I mean, it really was true that after the Watergate investigation, basically all reporters wanted to be investigative reporters. You know, the idea of bringing down corrupt politicians, it really did sort of put a new cast on the whole profession.
Alan, we already, everybody thinks terrible of the media and journalists, but Ben Bradlee stood up for something very important.
Well, he did. And it seems to me that after All the President's Men came out and the movie came out, he almost became a literary character. He was playing a part. He acquired the characteristics of a dashing fictional hero. And I think he tried to live up to that standard as much as he could.
Well, in addition to Ben Bradlee, we lost other political journalists as well. Marty Plisner, Dottie Lynch, and Bruce Morton from CBS News, Garrick Utley from NBC, Margot Adler from NPR. And speaking of NPR, one of its former presidents was Frank Mankiewicz, who passed away in October of this year. When I think of Frank Mankiewicz, I always remember this.
Senator Robert Francis Kennedy died at 1:44 a.m. today, June 6, 1968.
He was Robert Kennedy's press secretary. That was one of the saddest moments of my political memory.
It must be to have that kind of a sentence be the it's not on his tombstone, but the thing that people know him best for. I mean, obviously, he's a man who had an expansive and diverse career. But moments like that, that's the, you know, where were you when you learned that Robert Kennedy died kind of moment. And I remember getting the news myself.
One person who died this year never ran for office nor reported on a candidate, but he dealt with politicians and reporters. And that was James Brady, the press secretary for President Ronald Reagan.
There it is. Shots. Shot. Agents immediately diving after the assailant. There are two or three people down on the ground. We understand that one Secret Service agent, one, it may be another Washington policeman, who was injured. I can't hear the sound on this. Can't hear the sound. We understand also that James Brady, the White House press secretary, was among those injured.
That was Frank Reynolds of ABC News during live coverage of the assassination attempt on President Reagan in 1981. Sam Donaldson of ABC News remembers that terrible day.
Well, it was a terrible day. The president came out of the Washington Hilton. He'd been talking to an AFL-CIO trade union. And he waved as usual, and we were with our camera people, the three networks and some other reporters behind a rope, but it was not a dedicated press area. I mean, there were civilians there, and one of those civilians was John Hinckley Jr. He was about 5 or 6 feet away from me. I didn't see the gun being raised, but of course heard the shots and watched as the president looked alarmed, but didn't immediately appear to be hit. But I saw James Brady, Jim, fall to the sidewalk, and two other people. Turned out to be a Secret Service agent and a policeman from the District of Columbia. And the president was rushed into the car, pushed into the car, and drove away. There was chaos there, obviously. And I made what turned out to be the first report. But I did say shots had been fired at the president. We didn't know whether he was hit. And, of course, as you know now, he didn't think he'd been hit. He thought maybe the Secret Service agent who pushed him in the car had broken one of his ribs. But the agent, a really good, sharp guy, saw blood coming from the president's mouth, recognized it as a chest wound, and diverted the car to George Washington Hospital. And the president of the United States hitched up his pants. Ronald Reagan never went out in public without hitching up his pants, and walked out of the car and collapsed and was very near death. But Brady, as you point out, Ken, by the end of the afternoon, reports had circulated that he had died and was checked out at the White House. And they said, we heard the same thing.
Well, when you're standing there outside the Hilton and you're looking on the ground, you're seeing James Brady down, it must have been a horrific sight.
Well, my instant reaction was that it was fatal. Thank goodness I'm not a medical man. I didn't check him out, but he just fell like a sack on the ground. His head, of course, was punctured by the bullet, and blood was streaming from it. I didn't take a long time looking at the scene, though, because the president is shot at. Whether you think he's hit or not, you want to report it. And later, of course, Brady was taken to the same hospital where Ronald Reagan was taken. Doctors did not think he had much of a chance. But as Dr. Cobain, the great surgeon, said, we thought we ought to try. And brilliantly, because Jim did live until he was 73 years of age, and he was able to function to the extent that he knew who you were. He talked about things and made coherent sentences. He came to the White House regularly every week while Ronald Reagan was president. President Reagan did not replace him officially as White House press secretary. He always held that title, but he had aides, of course, who did the job.
Now, of course, when Reagan was shot on that March day, he was only president for about 2 months, but Brady had been with the president or been with Ronald Reagan during the campaign. What kind of a relationship did you have with Brady before the shooting?
Well, Jim Brady is one of those individuals that you always look for if you're a politician and you want a press secretary. He was loyal, of course, but at the same time was not slavishly in the mood to try to say black was white and white was black and up was down and down was up.
Which so many press secretaries do.
Well, that's right. I mean, reporters, as slow-witted as we may be, and the public is not going to accept just a slavish recitation of things that clearly are not the fact. Oh, the president was brilliant today and nothing happened. Yes, but didn't he fall down and, break his leg? Oh, no. Who told you that? I mean, that kind of ridiculous attitude. And Jim didn't have it. Jim could laugh. Jim could come out and say in those short 2 months, President Reagan today wants us to know X, Y, and Z, so I'm going to tell you X, Y, and Z. And with a wink and a nod, you knew that Jim was not saying he was going to swear his life on X, Y, and Z. He was loyal to the president, and he was going to tell us what we were supposed to hear. But at the same time, he didn't insult us by thinking that we would believe it all. I mean, every press secretary, we understand this, the job is to magnify and glorify the accomplishments of the office holder and minimize and blame others for any deficiencies that are seen in the president of the United States. And we accept that. You wouldn't expect the president to hire a press secretary who was always out there saying, oh, this guy really blew it today. No. On the other hand, people like Jim Brady did their job well for Ronald Reagan in this case, but at the same time did not insult the press corps into thinking that he could sell a bill of goods that clearly was simply a blowing of the steam rather than factual representation of the event.
That was Sam Donaldson of ABC News. Reagan had only been in office for 2 months. He was the oldest person ever elected president. And he was frighteningly close to an assassin's bullet. Jim Brady was less fortunate. His death was ruled a homicide 33 years after he was shot. He passed away in August.
Well, it's not classy to be bitter. And I try to be classy, as you know.
when you think of the people we lost in 2014, I mean, there were some, you know, giants there.
There are a number of people who served in the House that died this year. I think of Bill Frenzel, who died in his mid-80s. And Bill Frenzel was really a model of somebody who could be at once a partisan Republican and a Hail Fellow and somebody willing, when necessary, to work across party lines, the sort of moderate Republican who could play both ends. We really don't have people like that anymore. A very bright congressman from Minneapolis.
Yeah, he was one of those guys who left Congress just before the Republicans took over. He never saw the majority.
And he wouldn't have been very happy with it, I think.
Yeah, it's actually interesting to think about these people because most of them died in old age so that they spanned and reached back to another political era. You know, we commented on a couple of them that there aren't very many liberal Republicans anymore, not many Senate majority leaders like Howard Baker anymore, and probably, you know, fewer and fewer of the kind of machine politician mayors that we mourned this year.
Thanks to Janet Hook of The Wall Street Journal and Alan Ehrenhold of Governing Magazine for taking the time to reflect on these people today. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Good to be with you.
Thank you.
Politics is nothing without political junkies, so we asked our political junkie listeners to call in with their memories of political figures we lost this year.
Hi, Ken. My name is Ann Brecky. I'm calling from Chicago. I wanted to share a memory about Jane Byrne. For all her flaws, she was the first female mayor of Chicago and mayor of a major city. She got into office because Mayor Blandick, before her, didn't have the proper plan to remove snow, I think the 1979 blizzard, and that ushered in Jane Byrne. And there was a picture of her on the cover of Chicago Magazine, leaning her head out the window, yelling to the cabbie, "Take me to City Hall, fella." That encompasses Jane.
Hi, this is Joe Dixon. I'm calling from Washington, D.C. I'm calling about the one journalist who I will miss for the rest of my life, and it's actually British politics, so a bit outside of the realm. Simon Hogarth, he wrote parliamentary sketches for The Guardian. This man was hilarious and biting and insightful and prescient. And this is an example to the Tony Blair, listen to a Tony Blair speech, like going to the proms in London, where you come away exhilarated and you've learned nothing. Throw away the history books, go and buy a collection of his sketches. I cannot recommend them highly enough, so I will miss him.
Hello, it's Del Atwood calling, Ken, calling to memorialize, I guess, the dearly departed, and I would pick Jim Jeffords, who wasn't afraid to swim against the current.
Hi, Ken. This is John Moltmann in Milwaukee, Oregon. And I'd like to tell you about a politician who really made a difference in my life, who passed away this year at the age of 91. Governor Vic Atiyah of Oregon, who served two terms in the early 1980s. He was the last of a long list of moderate to even liberal Republicans who once represented this state, including Senator Bob Packwood and Mark Hatfield. When I was 12 years old, I called his office in Salem and asked if I could interview him for my social studies class. And I think I didn't really know any better at the time to realize that most sitting governors wouldn't be able to do something like that. In fact, his secretary told me that she didn't think it would be possible at all. But one day, he did say, "Come down to my office, that would be fine." And he let me interview him for well over an hour. Vic Atiyah was a very kind and gentle, humble man, and I will never forget how gracious he was. This is not the kind of politician we often find today, and it was a man who had a very big and wonderful heart.
Hi, Ken. Jim Murphy calling from Anaconda, Montana. I realize that Jim Traficant came to be thought of as something of a buffoon in the world of politics, but my very own fond memories of him go back a full half century to 1963-64 when he was a 22-year-old quarterback for the Springfield Acorns, minor league professional team in my hometown of Springfield, Mass., for which I was one of the equipment managers. Many of your listeners may be unaware that Jim was a big star at the University of Pittsburgh in the early 60s and was invited to training camp by, I believe, the Pittsburgh Steelers. He was an incredibly charismatic guy, not only in my own 15-year-old eyes, but with the rest of the team. He was an immensely popular team leader, took us all the way to the championship game in 1963. I was a shy, awkward, socially inept kid who took a lot of harassment from the other guys, but Jim went out of his way to be kind and supportive of me, even to the extent of taking the time to write me a very nice letter in the postseason. Ironically, in stark contrast to the Congressman Traficant we all remember, he was unanimously considered to be far and away the best-dressed guy on the team. Hard to believe, I know. And yes, his hair was noticeably thinning, even back then in his early 20s, so I, for one, was never among those who wondered whether or not that was a toupee. So people who are familiar only with his political persona can think of him what they will, but I'll always remember him as a guy who, although being a big-shot football hero, took the time to go out of his way to be nice to a 15-year-old kid. Rest in peace, Jimbo.
Hi, this is Luke Fazard calling from Madison, Wisconsin. I wanted this opportunity to honor a true legend of Wisconsin politics who passed away this year, former Governor Patrick Lucey. Now, many folks outside of Wisconsin, and frankly even those a few within it, don't realize that Wisconsin was solidly a Republican state from its founding in 1848 roughly until the 1960s. And along with William Proxmire and Gaylord Nelson, Governor Lucey built the Democratic Party of Wisconsin largely from the ground up, partly as a response to the rantings and ravings of our senator at the time, Joe McCarthy. A good story is that his very first race, he scored a huge upset victory by defeating the Speaker of the Assembly, by taking out local want ads in the paper and advertising himself as a handyman for the district to serve in Madison. Lucey later served as a state chairman of the Democratic Party and two terms as governor, where he was largely credited with being one of the finest governors the state had ever seen. He resigned in 1977 to become ambassador to Mexico under President Carter, and later in 1980 he became independent presidential candidate John Anderson's running mate as they ran on a unity ticket against both the incumbent President Carter and his Republican challenger Ronald Reagan. Up until his death, Lucey remained a loyal Democrat, but he repeatedly stressed bipartisanship. He worked closely with Republicans to accomplish a lot of great big things for the state, including the merger of Wisconsin's two university systems into one. He was truly a great man. He passed away in May at the age of 96, and he will be missed.
I've thrown away my toys.
But before we go, we thought we'd leave you with this song. She wasn't necessarily a giant in the political world. She ran for public office only once, a congressional seat in 1967, and lost. She served as ambassador to several countries, held some titles in the Republican Party, did a bunch of goodwill stuff. But that's when she was Shirley Temple Black. When she was just Shirley Temple, we had this.
On the good ship, lollipop, it's a sweet trip to a candy shop where bonbons play on the sunny beach in Peppermint Bay.
We lost Shirley Temple this year. She was 85. Of course, we can never really lose her. We'll always be on that ship together.
And there you are, happy landing on a chocolate bar.
Thanks for listening to the Political Junkie 2014 Remembrances Special. Political Junkie is made possible by the generous folks at WAMU 88.5 here in Washington and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. If you have questions or comments, or you want to share any of your own special remembrances of the past year, you can email me at ken@krpoliticaljunkie.com or find the Political Junkie on Facebook and Twitter. We've got one more show coming up before we close the book on 2014. Look out on Monday for our Year in Review show, when we'll take a broad look back at the big political stories that made headlines this year. Our producer and editor is A.D. Quigg. Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and webmaster, and Alex Drewinskis is our engineer. I'm Ken Rudin in Washington. Thanks for listening, and happy holidays.
Lollipop,
it's a night trip. Into bed you hop and dream away.
on the good ship, Lollipop.